diagram here in a question about relationships. I'm just copying the diagram. This represents two people. A is trying to express his will and is opposed by B. B can represent any superior power, whatever. Parents, authorities, the state. And the situation to be examined a little more closely results in A trying to put a pincer movement on B because of A's inferior power, and B, by superior power, is imploding into A. The result is that A begins to look, after a series of encounters, internally, something like this. His own attempts at expression are stopped by the superior force applied from outside. The question then goes on to reduce itself down to a simple proposition. How do we go about seeing the forces involved in such a relation? And how do we deduce a necessary working method to transcend that kind of relation? Well, the how question refers to mechanics, to something to do. And there is no method of doing anything other than by raising the level of awareness. So we have to draw our three-part man, head, chest, belly, with the coordinating spine. Down in the belly we have an urge, which is non-verbalized, and therefore unconscious. Unconscious does not mean that we are not aware of it, but means that the mode of awareness is not articulated verbally. And then we have liking and disliking in the feeling department, and we have ideas in the top, idea means form. Now, how are we going to see the forces involved in a stimulus situation? We can only do it by noting the total reaction of our being, and this is through feeling. Remember, in the evolution of the universe and of a human being, the field is prior to the existence. The existence is the finiting process. The X means out. The other part of the word is this together. Six fold. It means a wheel divided into six parts. To exist is to be circumscribed. And prior to circumscription, there is the power of infinity. We use paper to represent this power. The movements of the paper are movements of a sentient power. And when the movements so conform themselves to the circumscriber zone, which I represent by the chalk mark on the paper, we have then brought into being a finite existence. Now, this finite existence can be conceived easily in three totally different ways. We can consider the power involved in it, that all beings are power. We can consider the sentiency aspect of the being feels yes or liking and no or disliking, and the being is in a certain form. Idea is the Greek word form, shape is the section word. The question says, how do we see the forces involved in our relations? The answer is by, first of all, gaining field awareness. We must feel the whole body. It is only through feeling that we can make ourselves aware of the existence of power, that is primary drive, the existence of form, verbal articulation, and the existence of yes, no. I like it, I don't like it. Power is always positive. This is a three-part being, head, chest, belly. The power below in the belly, the intestinal drive of the Bible salesman in the film of Chicago. This power is always positive when it is awake, it never says no. It either says nothing or yes. So this power can only be felt, providing you are not involving your consciousness in identification with thinking processes. When you think concentratedly, you lose awareness of the drive in the belly zone. But this drive is really the original drive that has created the situation that gives rise to form. So really there are no ideas other than forms produced by power. And in the mode of production arises yes, I like it, or no, I don't like it. Quite simply, we restate, when the stimulus comes to any being, as the empty center of the being, the immanent spirit, when the stimulus comes to any being, the strength of the stimulus and the character of the receiving substance determine the mode of reaction. When the stimulus is very, very strong, we represent that in a very black arrow, then the being is overstimulated, the energy comes in faster than it can adjust to, and the result is the being is literally pushed away, displaced progressively. If the stimulus energy comes fairly lightly and easily, then the energy brought can be assimilated by the substance, and the sensation is one of pleasure. When energy comes at us no faster than we can absorb leisurely, and we call it pleasure. When the energy comes too fast, then we call it pain. There is a refusal. The refusal is simply caused by the overloading of the substance by the incoming energy of the stimulus. In drawing or painting, this is very important, because the stress accent on a line or a mass, a tone or a color, actually aggresses against the substance of an observer in certain ways. Color can be so aggressive that it becomes impossible to assimilate. Tone values can be too contrasted to assimilate easily. You can adjust the tone contrast on your TV till your blacks are too black, your lights are too light, and you have retinal difficulty in accommodating it, and you get eye strain. If you balance the grays properly, you can look for longer with less fatigue. You then have a being under stimulus at three levels. The lowest level, the application of power as such, sheer force striking the being. This is like a fist into the eye. Or if you like, at the lower level, a kick in the belly. If you get such a kick in the belly department, you feel it simply as an application of a force. If you then stimulate with less energy, you can find that the substance itself records in a different zone in the body that the energy coming in can be easily assimilated, and a yes is given to it, and pleasure is derived from the incoming stimulus energy. If you stimulate in another part very heavily, the result is the invasion of the substance with too much energy in the time units available. And the result is a nerve, a refusal, an attempt to stop it. There are nerves in the body that convey only impressions of pain. Some others are specialized in pleasure. When the mind is stimulated by words, the word itself has resonance, both from the written form, that is visual resonance, as when you recognize that a letter D is half a letter O, which is a semicircle, and therefore it resonates with half of the L and begins to formulate within the mind associations of ideas. In the insane, in schizophrenics and so on, this becomes very, very obvious that mechanical associations of ideas are occurring and triggering people into making faulty judgments. The question is, how do we see these things? The answer is, first, we feel more carefully. And we deliberately feel in the three levels of our body. If we concentrate field energy, which is the power of which we are made, in the head, we will step up the thinking process. If we concentrate it in the lower parts of the body, we will stimulate appetite of sex and food. If we place it in the chest region, we will find the kind of feeling that we call generally a affection, not in the technical sense that the psychologist used the word, but liking and disliking at the emotional level. So the hard question is, quite simply, learn to feel your being and the activities going on in the body. You know that if you get a sense of loss about anything whatever, you tend to get a drop in the region of the stomach, in the solar plexus. There's a real sensation like going down in a lift suddenly. If on the other hand you had a sensation that you had done a harm that you could not put right, you will find that the sensation is not centered in the same place, but is displaced over a wider area and tends to concentrate somewhere near the ribs. This is because all the processes in the body are really caused by field states in the body. The power field that constitutes the body absolutely is in a continuous state of flux, flowing, and it is also expanding and contracting, most obviously in the act of breathing. Less obviously, if you inhibit your breathing, hold your breath, you will discover that there is another kind of breathing going on, which you can call field breathing. You can inhibit, blow all the air out of your lungs, and hold them contracted, with the air expelled, and you will feel a tendency to expand, and if you conquer it and hold it, you will actually feel that something is pulling out. And this something is not the muscle structures of the chest trying to make you breathe on it. It is actually a field of power which is expanding and which will triumph if you persist in holding your breath. It will overcome your individual determination to hold your breath by making you breathe. If you hold your breath till you faint, which can be done, you may remember that the Everest expedition men did this as an exercise. If you do that, then as soon as you have fainted, this field of energy will make you breathe while you are unconscious. And this, of course, is a life preservation movement. Now, how do we work knowing this fact? First of all, we see that the power level, the belly level, is not subject to analysis by itself. It is not interested in analysis, it is only interested in push. If it is not asleep, it is pushing. So if you try to verbalize the content of the belly level, all you will find is, I want and I am pushing to get what I want. You mustn't expect a more complicated reply from the belly level than the simple, I want and I am determined to get. And when you come into the level of the chest, into the emotional liking, disliking zone, then you find that you have quite simply a duality of yes and no. And we've said before, this is quite simple. The belly is a pure unity of power. The chest level is a duality of yes and no. Now, because of the dialectical fact of the universe, you cannot have an unadulterated yes in a complex, finite situation. If you could find one single element which had a definite characteristic X, and it were pure, so that it had only one effect on your being, then you could say, I will say yes to it or no to it. You could give it an unqualified yes or no, like Christ says, you should let your yea be yea and your nay, nay. But if you come to a being that is made of parts, we say three parts, because of the polarization into posnae and the positive negative of the link factor between the two, when you have a three-part being, although itself is one being, that is, it has a binding line that creates it as a unity and binds the parts of it together, you cannot give an unqualified yes or no to the whole of it, but only to the part of it. So that if you come to a being called positively beautiful, you will find with it that it has a negatively desirable habit to go with its positive beauty. And you may find that it has a certain neutrality, a plus-minus quality, that it tends not to like you or to dislike you to the degree that you would require. If it likes you fully, it would embrace you and devote itself to you. If it dislikes you fully, it would go away and that would be the end of that problem. But there is a neutral element in beings that makes them neither like nor dislike you. so they don't miss you enough when you go away, and they're not joyful enough when you come to see them. This makes it very difficult in a complex situation to see just how you are going to give an unqualified yes or no. And as all the parts are related together functionally, it becomes practically impossible to give a straight yes or no to any of the parts in isolation, because they are not functional in isolation. It then becomes almost impossible to give yes or no to any given existing entity. Therefore, if you are to give an unqualified yes to life, you must have another method of thinking about it in order to guarantee your positivity in situations of themselves either neutral or negative. And this is the concept of the cross, as the Celtic cross of the Christians, which of course is considerably older than historical Christianity, and which is not older than cosmic Christianity. The cosmic logos has for its symbol this cross, the arms of which transcend the circle. The circle represents any finite circumscribed zone. The vertical transcendent arm represents a force that goes beyond the finite, into the finite, and again beyond it. The horizontal represents the extension of substance, the passive aspect of power, transcending the finite substance of the being, entering it, and again transcending it on the other side. Now, if we can see that the essential problem for infinite power is this, the paper is all there is. That is only infinite power. This power is sentient and self-moving. The paper moves itself. In so doing, it produces ripples. These ripples are forms we could analyze in a drawing, and if we wave it from different points, we could make intersection points, and at the intersection points there would be a vortex created, which is the automatic product of opposing forces in a fluid medium. When we see that this is all there is for the paper a problem which it must face. The problem of the fact that although it is infinite power and therefore omnipotent, although it is in its formal motion the totality of all formal possibilities in actuality, and therefore it is omniscience, nevertheless, although it has all power and is all knowing, as soon as it activates itself and circumscribes any zone within its omnipotence and omniscience, it has, by a superstress, brought to be a finite situation in which there is an inside and an outside. Simultaneously, the creation of a boundary, the rotation of a force, circumscribes and thus encloses and limits and excludes infinity, so that at one blow the first creative act of infinity is to produce finity. Creation means finitizing. The cosmic logos, you can tell by the word cosmic itself, tells you about a ka and ma, and it's the cosmos, that it is a closed system. That is the circle in which there is no bigger, called by some theologians God. And that is not the God of the Gospel of John, that is a God, namely cosmic logos. That is a being circumscribed like a sphere with an equator and a polar axis. That is the cosmic logos. And because it has come to be circumscribed, it has excluded infinity. And in so doing has reduced itself from omnipotence to finite potency, from omniscience to relative knowledge. If the sphere manages to reduce its frequency back into the absolute level, it ceases to exist as a finite. That's the concept of the Buddhist pursuit of nirvana. Reduce your individual stress to the level of the absolute, make your hay function to the Allah level, and you cease to exist as an individual and therefore constitute no problem. But if you do so, you are not actualizing some of your potentials, namely the negative potentials. All the positive potentials are absolutely eternal. But the negative ones can only be brought to be by superstressing and thus inducing internally to infinity finite. And straight away, absolute free spirit has generated a zone of relative free dome. And freedom itself is a contradiction in terms, namely the free and the dome, the free and the bound. If we rub out the dome, all we have is the free, but the free doesn't exist. We cannot even use the word have. We cannot say we have this free, because have already implies, more obviously in the German haben, to have, implies a finite process. To have, to comprehend, to possess, and so on, are all finite processes. So what human beings are pursuing in the name of freedom is really a contradiction in terms. And consequently, to make an absolute affirmative, we have to learn to affirm a negative. That is, we have to learn to say yes to all the things we're going to say no to. And we have to learn to say it in principle. And when a stimulus comes to any being, and the stimulus is so fast that it hurts the being tends to run away. But if we put inside this being a concept, we'll put an item of Dobbin inside it, we'll put the Star of David inside it and say, this concept means that every time a stimulus divides me, I will see something I did not see before. This is Da and Din. When a dividing energy comes to me, then I see something. So the Star of David tells me, as a governing concept, that when I am being hurt, I am also being educated. And if I can say that the amount of education I receive for a given pain gives me as much form as the pain has given me unpleasantness, then I will affirm the incoming painful energy. And instead of running away from it, I will stand there and let it come. If I'm very greedy, I might actually run onto it. The important thing is that by means of this device, which we can call the affirmation and the acceptance of crucifixion in the situation, we convert all negatives into positives. That is, every rotten situation, every painful situation, every situation we want to get out of, instead of saying those harsh things about them, we affirm they're all very, very good. And this immediately converts all that men call evil into good. In the Bible, it's obvious that he said of God, he can bring good out of evil. How does he do it? He does it by allowing the evil, that is the excess energy in the situation, to produce information. This information enlightens the being. And when a being is very heavy and inert, rotating very slowly and fairly comfortable, if a bit stagnant, when that being is there and stimulus comes very rapidly, it shakes the being. It shakes the being violently and breaks its inertia. So it enlightens. It takes the weight off it and illuminates it simultaneously. By this method, then, you can convert all negatives into a positive. So that this part of the question is answered now. How do we see these things? We see by becoming more and more feeling conscious of the different levels of our own being. Our own being was originally a sphere, an egg. The egg was polarized, the spinal axis laid down, a diaphragm is put across it, and then the part is divided into two, and top part pushed up to become the head. So a human being is made out of a sphere. And this sphere has a potential human in the field around it. Not inside the egg, in the nucleus of the egg, not in the so-called chromosomes or the genes thereon, but in the field surrounding these things, the human being is there pressing into the form and out to express itself. Now, we have another question here we can tie up with this. This question is called the question in music, because it keeps hiding in the role of faith. It was stated that Uspensky never got from Gurdjieff that language without which man cannot begin to think. It was stated that this was because he was deficient, and nothing is given to the deficient. How does this apply to us? Our presence here advertises our deficiency. That's pause for a commercial, actually. Well, Gurdjieff, of course, was a supreme leg puller, and when he made a statement like that, he knew there's a lot of men, each one of which would individually be called a dummkopf, would misinterpret what he was saying. To be deficient is to be lacking part of the verb to do or make. It means to be not actualizing one's potentialities. When he said that Uspensky hadn't been given this because he was deficient, he could have equally well said the same thing about any other being, providing he did not say in what part of his being he was being deficient. Even Gurdjieff was being deficient when he died of a disease for which he was being treated, and the treatment was not effective. He wasn't lifted up on the mountain top, suffused with glory, and carried away before an admiring crowd, and photographed by telecameras. He was, in fact, deficient at the moment of death. The finite, as we have just seen, is deficient, because to exist as a finite is to be deficient. So when it says, the language is that which man cannot begin to think, it's a very, very nice statement, but it wants modifying a little. That language is that which man cannot begin to think in the way that he would like to think if he knew what that mode of thought could do for him. That would be better. And as for deficiencies, a man is deficient in general on one of the three levels. He's either deficient in power, sexual drive, appetite for din-din, hurry back home soon for two reasons, and deficient in emotions. He doesn't really know if he likes it or dislikes it, because he hasn't got strong liking or disliking, or he's deficient in rational capacity. Broadly, you can examine yourself for a specific deficiency, your special deficiency, what he would have called chief point. Most people are deficient in some part of their being more than another part, and this deficiency constitutes their individual characteristic. If you imagine a person with no deficiencies whatever, he must be absolutely perfect. If there is another being of the same order, he must be indistinguishable from the first being. And for this reason it is said that the objective universal truth perceived by the sages is identical. But the finite existential being of the sages on earth, their physical body, is far from being an identical object. Gautama Buddha at 80 died of an internal disorder. Having attained nirvana spiritually did not stop his physical body becoming worn out. An old Jewish friend of mine who is now nearly 80, one of his eyes is just becoming quite blind, and he says, I don't expect my headlights to be in such good condition today like they were 80 years ago. That's a matter of finite existence. Now let's have a look at this mysterious language without which man cannot begin to think in the way he would like to think if he knew what it could do for him. It happens that all language is quite simply the function of the modification of a prime sound by altering the chambers in which the sound is produced. In the language of the Tao Te King, there is one spirit, or wind, blowing in holes. All the holes are of different sizes and different shapes. Means the individual existences of individual human beings can be considered to be conditioning factors or queer-shaped holes through which universal spirit blows. Now, we'll draw a hole. There's a triangular hole. Here's another hole. A semicircular hole. It's trying to stand up. If we blow a wind through a Toblerone packet, then the resonances inside that packet will not be the same as they would be in a semicircular one or in a nice tin of pan shine with the lid and the bottom knocked out. In other words, the conditioning factors which produce individuated sounds are quite simply the characteristic shapes presented by elementary geometrical structures. Now, if we examine this in relation to the human being, so I'm using it so much paper, there is a device in the economy of the human being, the vocal apparatus. There's a nice windbag down there with a tube up, special breath control device in the larynx, a direction of air for vocalizing, toning, another direction through the mouth for whispering, making non-voiced letters. When we look at this, we find that this is a highly adaptable resonance chamber. And if we examine the nature of the letters of the alphabet, we find we can, in fact, reduce them to simple geometrical shapes. If you hold the tongue flat in the mouth, so when you open your mouth, what you see is the arch at the back, and the tongue flat, it will pronounce the letter R. So you see that the letter R, as we write it, can be considered to be a diagram of the flat tongue in the mouth and the arch of the mouth. In square letters, we make it like this, when we use the straight lines. If you depress the tongue and pull it down, well it, round the lips, you pronounce the letter O. If you lift the tongue up against the roof of the mouth, till it's almost like a crescent, you pronounce the vowel A. If you press it up till there's only a very tiny little hole, you pronounce the vowel E. Now it becomes obvious from this that when we use the vocal apparatus for making sounds, we are really manipulating changes on a highly adaptable instrument to produce sounds corresponding with geometrical states of being, which states of being are stresses and strains within the organism. So if we say O when we are surprised, we are really stretching the being as far as we can to its limits, and it automatically tends towards verticality because it is flying away from the concept presented to it. It is surprised. Oh, if you say instead of E, that's a different kind of exclamation, and it means they've seen the point, really. It's rather clever. Oh is a pure surprise. You put them both together, it gives you the Yiddish word, read from outside to inside, sign of lamentation, hand to be placed on the side of the head, oi. If you read it from the inside to the outside, it says yo, which is the Hebrew for God, the affirmative part. Now we have the oldest name of God in the world is a row of vowels. I've left off the two absolute vowels, diphthongs, which complete the seven letter form, and put the simple five-letter form, E-A-R-O-U. Don't anglicize these vowels, because the English vowels are largely diphthongs. We say A-E for A. We say O-U-O for O, which should be O. Use Italian vowels, or French vowels, or German vowels. Don't use English ones. The English people say E for this sign. It is A. They say I, R-E, for this letter, which is E. The E-A-R-O-O. Pronounce it quickly, yow, and then you can spell it like this, if you like. Now this yow is an old name of God. You call it Yahoo, if you like Swift does, but he knows what he's talking about. The reason a row of vowels is used to symbolize God is because God is free spirit, and vowels are made by not interrupting, not stopping, not kicking or floating the air on the way out. So when you pronounce a row of vowels, you have really pronounced a series of geometrical things, which I will rapidly put underneath: a dot, a plane, a hemisphere, a full sphere, and a ball thrown through space. Now that is the geometry of those vowels. So that when you come to examine in a picture or in a work of art, generally, the meaning of things, you will find you are dealing with a sphere, O, with an equatorial plane, A, and the hemisphere, R, with another one, the negative hemisphere below, called gravity R, falling R, deprivation, without E, the dot in the middle, and the whole thing thrown violently through space, U. So that when you come to examine your concepts in the light of this fact, you see that the name Yo, which is pronounced by English people through a confusion of Jehovah and Adonai, two different Hebrew words, one of them having been given the points belonging to the other. When you pronounce this word Yahu, you're pronouncing the word Jehovah in its original form, serialized. But in infinity, these things are not said separately, they are said simultaneously. If you try to pronounce the vowel E, you will find you cannot make it clean. You can hear a very definite round sound in it that doesn't belong to it. This is because there is a little sphere where you're lifting up your tongue against the roof of the mouth. There's a little spherical place. So the E becomes O. Now you can prove this very simply on a tape recorder. If you record at a very high speed the vowel E, and then slow it down progressively by re-recording, you will find that it is sounding like O. And if you do the same thing in the reverse way, record O, and then double up the speed, the vowel will change. When you increase the speed, it moves from U, O to E. When you decrease it, it moves from E to O to U. And that you can prove to yourself on your tape record. This means that every E is really U, every U is really E. Now the E, or dot, the jot in the Bible, means form, and the U means power. So Kabbalistically we say, there is no form that is not a power, and there is no power which is not formative. Now this is the identity of opposites in the pre-Babel language which we are now examining. Remember that in the book of Genesis it says that men were behaving so badly, so ambitiously, that God came and confused their speech. God did it, they didn't do it. There are 72 languages described by the ancients, most of them now lost. And these languages we can find by simply going back to the primary geometry. And when we do so, we rediscover the language that was spoken before man's ambition caused God to confuse man. Now, what does it mean to say that God confused man because of his ambition? Does it mean that there was a God set over against man, and that man was set over against God, and there were two beings, and that man was being ambitious in one place, and God was watching him from another place, and thought, I will go and confuse him? It doesn't mean that at all. There is nothing other than the paper waving. And one of the little wave complexes of that paper is a circle called man. Looks a bit like an apple, doesn't it? An apple will finish it off. This is man, the being that does all the applications in the universe. This man means evaluator, is simply the modifications of infinite power, where the modifications are engaged in reflexive activity, meditating on their source. In man, the infinite power of God, of supreme power, omniscient spirit, whatever you like to call it, that infinite power has precipitated a complex form called man. That form is now factually able to consider its origin. It is trying to discover who it is, what it is, where it's come from, where it's going to. So man represents the precipitated God, and this is a great mystery of the divine humanity of Christ. He is man as to his finity, and therefore suffers on the cross of the situation, as to his essential non-difference from the infinite power he is God. The whole problem, theological problem of the nature of Christ, is seen dialectically in the fact that absolutely there is nothing other than God, and therefore if there is a finite, it is God finite in that place. And when we see this fact, we can see that the whole geometry of the sphere with its consequent vowel forms inside are involved, that is, in-willed, pressed in, into every individual man. Therefore, man is a god in little. When the rabbis accuse Christ of making himself equal to God, he simply quotes the Old Testament at them, "Is it not written, ye are gods?" Every man is a little god for the simple reason there cannot be anything other than God, absolutely. If there were, there would be a duality. Therefore, man is simply God modalizing himself in the manner called man, that is, evaluator of origins. Now, we see here that because of being is finite, it is deficient, because it's circumscribed. It has three main divisions, better leave a hole in the middle, and idea, feeling, and urge. Looks like a German trademark, Efu. The idea, feeling, and urge in this being are subject to three orders of stimulation. Those three orders, if you are not aware of them, can cause a schism, as they call it these days, a schism, to be more accurate, a separation of the functions of the being, so that the idea level of the being becomes totally estranged from the feeling level of the being, and both of them from the urge level of the being. So that a man can have an idea that he's a decent type, feel absolutely no compassion for other human beings, and proceed urgently to put a lot of jam on his bread when nobody's looking, without in any sense feeling inconsistent. That is caused by the departmentalization of his being, by these three orders of stimulus. The process goes on in here, which Gurdjieff calls self-calming, that is, telling oneself nice statements about why one should do this under the circumstances, considering there's nobody about. It doesn't make any difference in any case. Now, by means of this mysterious writing, we can analyze any proposition whatever. A few days ago, I meant to say a professor, a Scottish Kabbalist, James Bonaventura Heaven. We first thought in this place, because you can find out where it is, and he's written to the Vatican in the British Museum. Then he found that he did exist, and he hadn't really done anything much. Then he found that he had done something, and in any case, he was a Scotsman. Blowing his Scottish trumpet. And one of the things he illustrated, wrote up on the blackboard, showing how foolish this mission was really, was a cubic alphabet called a cubic alphabet. Now, if you were to draw a series of squares and write a letter, you say in English, letter A, in the first column, and we'd make one of the columns for each letter. And then we'd write again here, A, B, C. And the same down here, A, B, C. Now, if we go down here, we want to spell a certain letter in the English. We need that one out, represented on this page. A, and we go down here onto this line, A, B, R. You could say it's an Latin prefix, and a word. From. In Hebrew, Abba means father. So if we say that in the Allah, and that was a bed, yeah. Abba means father. And then we need me. We go down here to the Abba, the, and that means destruction. Now, by the addition of the letter D, which means division, into the word for father, suddenly father becomes destructive. And this he thought, and the other theologians there, thought highly amusing, tremendously stupid. Yes, how silly can you get? And then there's a statement, this fellow, along with other Kabbalists, believed, quite erroneously, that the use of language could help you to understand the universe. Now, in fact, the mere fact that he was lecturing and using a language, and assuming that his students were understanding anything whatever about the study that he had undertaken, refuted him. Because if language did not in fact, clarify the nature of the universe, he had no right to be there, and a university is a farce. I did not point that out to him at the time, because he was surrounded by friends. Now, the important thing is that if you understand the nature of these letters, you can begin to see the roots of words. And the roots of words are so determinant that if you get hold of the root of a word, and so that you can actively define it, you will release yourself from a whole group of stimuli which would otherwise determine your life course. You know what propaganda is, you know what advertising is. You've all probably read that book, Hidden Persuaders, by now. No doubt. Now, if you read any of the literature on mechanistic behaviorism, conditioned reflexes, and so on, you will find that millions of dollars in America and hundreds of thousands of pounds in England are being expended on research into conditioned reflex theory and its relation to the man in the street, who is going to absorb the commodities manufactured by these firms. In order to condition a man, you must be able to hit him with a stimulus. And you can hit him on the sexual level and food level, the primary urge. You can hit him on the disliking and liking level. Do you love your mother or girlfriend? Do you hate your daddy or brother? If you're a boy. And you can hit him on the rational level. Have you read any good books lately? This mode of analysis is used by advertisers and by political propagandists, and all the beings who don't know the rule governing this are called people. And we've defined people before, and we've defined public, and we've defined the poli, the poloi. They're all polluted by too much attention at the lower end, which causes the blood to migrate from the brain and the brain cells to be oxygen starved and to degenerate as a result. Now, the language that we are going to examine is concerned with the symbology. And we'll write the name of God again, E-R-U. I've written E at the top, the little vowel, the yod, because it means form, compaction. I've written R in the middle because it means aspiration. And I've written U down below because it occurs in the word U. Some man yours for me, for the mystic you could see. E-R-U is the name of God. We put the intermediate vowel, E, on the larynx and O on the stomach. We now have the divine man in his vowel form. The word vowel, of course, means bowel. And the noise that comes out of the vowel, either down or up, uninterrupted by compressions of the tissue structures, is called a vowel. So that the vowel E means a point or a form or an idea. The vowel R means energy of aspiration. If it's negative, it's energy of falling down. The vowel U means prime urge, primitive force, sexual urge, urge to food, and so on. The vowel A between E and R shows you that between E, the form, and R, the aspiration, something is going on, and that is feeling. And the larynx has a thyroid gland which is peculiarly related to the emotional life. It is on the level of the letter E, A. And the stomach department, looks like a ball if you don't watch it, is the comprehender of the whole thing, the thing into which you throw the matter which breaks down and then becomes a food or power urge. So the divine man in his free aspect is represented by vowels. But that's only part of the divine man, namely his free aspect. His bound aspect has the consonants. Consonants are letters that you sound with. They're consonant. Sound with the vowels. Again, we have a man. He has lips and teeth, palate, and on the lips he pronounces M, and he can float it into P, B, F, V. There's a name. The adjective is the lips. And because these are forward in the mouth, and the vocal apparatus is like the whole man. The forward part belongs to the head and is analytic and specific, the precision of P, and it tears the thing and chops it with the teeth and the dents, which Mr. Nurse knows all about. The dental or dental, from the root DN meaning to judge. When the teeth bite into a situation for analytical purposes, to trap teeth, and the tearers on the edge and then the grinders at the back, you are indulging in an analytical process. The nerve endings going to these teeth have certain connections with parts of the brain, so that if you do a lot of worrying, you can actually get trouble with these teeth. If you do too much analysis, you can get tooth trouble, which is one of Rudolf Steiner's favorite thoughts, that he had a lot. And as you're moving backwards in the mouth, you're moving nearer and nearer to the gullet, which is the belly department. So you can write in the mouth again, E, A, R, O, U. There is a man in the mouth, which is why Jakob Boehme says, "Behold, dear beloved reader, the secret is verily in your mouth and on your tongue." The tongue itself is zoned in a certain way. You can examine this at your leisure, experimentally. And it tells you information about things sweet, sour, and bitter on the different parts of the tongue. Sweet, sour, and bitter have to do with some of the planets. And they have to do with certain forces in your being. The sweet is the thing you like. The sour is the thing that puts you off it. And the bitter is the thing that reduces you to bits and clarifies your idea in the process. On the lips, then, you have M, the great secret letter, the sacred B, B, F, V. They're all letters to do with this final expression, this clarification. P, B. They're external things. On the teeth, you have analytical ones. T, D, and blow through T becomes S, blow through D becomes Z. Blow through T with a little flattening of the tongue. Th, and D, V. You have this in the word thin, F in thin, the TH in thin is unvoiced, but in the word then it is voiced. There's two kinds of TH, and sh, that's TH blown through, and je, as in the French, je, and in the English word azure, sometimes called azure, the tongue. So we have a lot of letters there, right on the teeth, T, D, S, Z. Just behind them and spread a bit, th, th, sh, z. Then on the middle of the palate we have L and R, although the Scots pronounce it R forward and the Germans pronounce it backward at the middle. When it's pronounced very forward, it shows a remarkable analysis intellectual. When it's pronounced very backward, it shows that the analysis is going on at the gullet level of power, which is why Montgomery always bubbles his arm. At the back we have K and G. So we've now got left H, the symbol of breath itself, the aspirate letter, and a letter N, pronounced here continuously, where the palate is moving towards the teeth. In Sanskrit you can pronounce this N along the palate in different positions, including NG, Nga. Might be pronounced something like it in the word horn. English, as opposed to nice, probably. We've now got the letters of the mystical alphabet. All you have to see then is the function of these things in the mouth. At the back of the mouth, you have the belly representative, and K and G. Now, all the unvoiced letters, like K, and letters sh, anything you can whisper, and those are unvoiced. But all the letters that you voice have M sounding in them. We draw a line under the unvoiced ones and we write underneath them the voiced equivalent. And when we voice it, we're adding M, and M means substance. So we have G is K plus M, G. In fact, in Greek, you sometimes find, well, Greek, PM is a way of writing V. V. Because you put the lips in the position of P, and you make the sound of M behind it, and it goes V. So I actually write it PM, which is phonetically quite ridiculous. Under the sh, we have z. Underneath, we have z. Underneath, we have z. Underneath, that, we have z. Underneath, we have v. Underneath, v. We've now got our consonantal structure with special cases added, H-M-N, the origin of the word human. And the mysterious letter N, which runs through here, means continuity of processes, and the linked letters, which can be either voiced or not voiced, L and R. They occur in a nice old-fashioned word, rule, and lord, which is the same word. Remember, you analyze these things primarily without the vowels, and then you put the vowels in as qualifiers. We know the function of these letters. K and G have to do with the gullet. Those on the top line have to do with the intellectual analysis of those facts. Those on the bottom line have to do with the substantial existence of those facts. So if you find a word, a nice simple word like gump, it starts off with a hard G, which means the bloke is fairly gross. That's already made with an M in it. It's got the oo from down the belly department in it. It has an exodose of M, which is substance, and then suddenly it desubstantializes itself and says again. So if you can imagine what it feels like to be a gum, then you've got the significance of this word. I don't think it's just an imitation word. It isn't, there aren't any. When there springs up in the minds of soldiers and front or engineers in their workshops strange primitive sounding words, they are true words springing out of the level at which they function, usually from down below. They are subject to proper analysis and they have significance. Now let's look at another word and see what happens if we write it on the two levels. Let's take the word philosophy. That's, we can voice the vowel or we can whisper it. We'll whisper it because the preceding consonant has actually got itself unvoiced. It's all whispering. That means that the whole of philosophy is an intellectual proposition. Now let's make another word. Bill, Oz, O, B. Sounds a bit Russian, doesn't it? What would this mean? It would mean that we'd have to get down to the ground to turn philosophy into below the B. Already it sounds a little heavily Germanically pedantic. If we make a change like this, we begin to feel why this thing has got a tradition behind it with substantiality. Don't be afraid of turning one letter into another. There's a phonetic rule that governs this. Part of it you may know as Grimm's Law, which is a very simple one for turning all the European languages into each other by a simple rotation of the consonants. If you have a P, you can turn it into a V. If an F, into a V. T, into D. And so on. So if we take the English word leather, and we remember that a medial TH in English is a D in German, and they don't use that letter A in the middle because they don't have our vowel problems, then the German word leder is the English word leather. That's part of the sound shift law. Now, whenever a people change one sound into another, it is because of a very deep need in themselves to express their being level. So we'll find in German strange terms that we do not find in French or English, which appear in Germanic philosophy. We can find a word like this, Urgrund. Now that Urgrund is a term which we don't find elsewhere. And the Germans are a people, like the word German suggests, the evaluator who breaks up their They're earthbreaker uppers. And so they like to get down to it. They're very fond of the word grunt. That means foundation, basic. The grunt sounds a bit different from basic. And the ur here means power differentiated, which is the ur in the original. So in Jakob Böhme's work, you will find the word urgrunt. And you will find ungrunt. Now, such terms are tremendously valuable because they convey a concept which you cannot convey in any other word. Every word is peculiarly itself, and it's for this reason that it is physically impossible to translate a poem from one language to another. You cannot translate a poem and retain its value from one language to another, because the essence of a poem is that its significance is involved in the sound. So if you change one sound to another, you haven't made the same poem in another language, you have made another poem. Poems are concerned with power substantialized. We now have a mode of analysis, which ties up with the other question. How are we to go to work to discover the forces acting upon us? We can do so by asking ourselves, when we feel that the stress is in the belly department, how many words can we find to express this state that use M letters, and its voice letters, and the back K again? So we've got the intellective come, which is already hybrid, because K is intellective and M is substantial, and the substantial G and M, gum, gamma, and so on. How many words can you find that have functions of this kind in? Those have to do with the belly level, and if you take an old sense, I'll take the Persian form of it, looks a bit like a fellow at a football game. Now this word, M-U-G-H, yeah, M-U-G aspirate, mug, is a mug, is mug, is substance, power, substantiated. It is the Persian word for magical power. Our word magic shows that U has become A, G is softened to J, and I, K, becomes intellective. Magic. From move, the primary development of belly power, as the Zen exponent would say, primary will, driving towards its end, and everything it's got positing into it, has become in us a substantial aspiration, softening of the effort, reduction to analytical points, intellectualization. Now, we can import into it a meaning and save it for our own sakes by saying a substantial energy, grossly established, particularized, clarified in the mind. That is magic. But it's really magic. And it's better magic. It's even better magic. It sounds like a Russian magic gone soft. When we find, using a dictionary, that the words that we are digging up to express what we feel predominate in back consonants and back vowels, know that we are referring to the belly region. If we find that the consonants and vowels are made in the middle of the mouth, it refers to the chest region. And if we find that the vowels and consonants are made forward in the mouth, it refers to the intellect. So you find our friend Bertrand Russell and company using forward vowels because they're intellectually analytic. So we see now, nothing is told to the deficient, but everybody is deficient. So if we are talking to beings, we must be talking to the non-deficient parts of them. What we're doing, in fact, is this. Inside everybody, there is an immanent spirit. Paul says our conversation is in heaven. Around that immanent spirit is the zone of deficiency, and we are talking now, when we're talking basically from immanent spirit to immanent spirit, and we're hoping for a two-way traffic. so that the seeds of phonetic symbols shall fall on good ground. There shall be a real response determining itself in act into a definite attempt to feel the different levels of energy in the body and how they move from time to time, how an external stimulus can knock you out of an intellectual process to a consideration of your next meal, and to become aware of this shift of levels of energy which is going on in the body from external stimulation, and then to find those words that you can within your vocabulary that adequately express the feeling experience you have, and to see from the domination of consonants and vowels that the experience belongs at a certain level. By doing this, the whole process becomes clarified, and the thing is lifted up, and you are getting the sprach to feel the feeling for this primitive pre-Babylon language. As you become progressively more aware of the feeling of these sounds, so you get more control over your own being, and dialectically, so the distance between you and the other person who hasn't done so increases, which is a grave danger. If you get to know too much about it and become too familiar with it, you can, if you don't set up a special stimulus in yourself, forget that nobody else knows anything about it and start throwing precious pearls about, and then you will find that they are not appreciated as pearls, which resolves itself down into the superglyph of all yogis, which being interpreted means keep your mouth shut. Remember that deficiency is the property of every finite, but not to bother with the deficient finite. Remember that within the deficient finite, right in the center, is immanent spirit, which is in no sense deficient. To identify with that immanent spirit in yourself, to see that the external stimulus that disturbs your vehicle of deficiency cannot reach into the level of the internal spirit, and therefore it cannot be attacked, and therefore it is absolutely secure. And then to talk from your center of absolute security to the center of the same in another person, and thus bypass the zones of deficiency. That is the relation called truly personal. Whereas the relationship at the deficient level, the level of the merely material external stimulus response of being, is of itself unproductive, always dissatisfying, and certainly the producer of all the misunderstandings that exist in the world.